Okay, let's get started. Like I said, I'm seeing some familiar names, and I know some of you are actually traveling with several people in your car, and some of you here have upwards to three, four, and five people. So the actual crowd here is bigger than the screen shows. So let's go ahead and get started. Welcome. My name is Peter Pearson. I'm with Kansas Specialty Crop Growers Association. I'll be hosting today's session. Just some quick introductions. We'll all have a chance to see each other. Those of us that will be participating in the in-person tours later will have a chance to connect a little bit closer. But Don and Mary, I see, are here from Kansas Farmers Union, our two partner growers. Leah is here from Firefly Farm, and Chris, and I see Sean is here too, Chris and Shauna Tecklenburg from Tech Farms in Hutchinson. Manreet Boulart with Kansas State Food Safety is here. He's going to help us as best he can to answer some of the questions we might have for him regarding the food safety. The framework for the day, right now we've got three online presentations from the two partner growers. We're going to literally get a virtual tour and an overview of their operations, their history, and their current operations. We'll get about 20, 25 minutes each, and then we'll go into a more focused look at their evolution and how that impacted their foods, their thinking about food safety requirements and food safety practices. So that'll be part three. And then there'll be an hour and a half break. And I know quite a number of you are actually going to be going to the Firefly Farm, and we'll give some Rise Up Rooftop Operations. We'll give some more information on that as we close up today. But again, welcome everybody. Just a quick reminder, everyone, mute yourselves unless you're talking, presenting to the group. And with that, let's get started. I want to bring up a PowerPoint. This is Tech Farms overview. I'm going to do a screen share.
Hey, Peter.
Yes.
I just might point out that Tricia Wanko with National Farmers Union is on today.
Yeah, I see her. She got kind of cut on my page too. Yes, Tricia, thank you from the national office. Thank you. You got tucked onto my second page. Thanks for bringing that to my attention.
He's asking if you plugged in a headset.
Oh, I did.
Okay. Chris and Shauna? It's all yours.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. Thank you. We're honored to be here. We're happy to be here. We're honored to be part of this group. And thank you for asking us to share our story and how we come to be Tech Farms. This is where we're at. We're in Hutchinson. We're on the west side, about where 12th would be, in Hendricks. We used to live where that top right arrow is, that house right above that arrow on the east side of Hendricks. We used to live over there, and this used to be an empty lot. Nothing was on that lot. It was, some of the history of this area was an old apple orchard in Hutchinson. It's got a lot of alluvial river deposits. Soils from the Arkansas River. So a lot of mullet, a lot of dark, deep, sandy loam soils. This piece of ground, like a lot of little piece of grounds around this area, was empty. It is went to brome or to, some native grass. In the 30s, it was farmed. It does have some farming history to it. And there was an old homestead when they did the apple orchard on it. But this is my wife, Shauna, and I'm Chris. And these are our children here. We have three children. Tyler traded in the Navery. So this farm is a family farm. A lot of workers. those children help out. Tremendous help. I have two-part jobs. Hey, Peter, do I need to go faster? Okay. So I currently have a full-time job with the USDA NRCS. I've worked for the Natural Resource Conservation Service for 21 years, and I still do. My wife, she worked as a massage therapist, started her own business in the town of Hutt for 20 plus years. Since retired, and retired from the massage therapy business, and is working full time at the farm. We couldn't do that without her. Our hobbies are gardening, if you can imagine that. But we like to go to the lake, fishing, be outdoors. That's what we enjoy. We are on a website, techfarms.com. We're continuously building that and upgrading that. We are on Facebook and Instagram as well. So Tech Farms, I showed you where we lived previously. I saw that piece of ground and I just kept looking at it. It was for sale. It was for sale for 2 or 3 years. Nothing was on it. You know, it's a story in itself, but we ended up purchasing that land in 2016. It's a bootstrap farm, and we build everything from the ground up. Our mission here is to make nutritious food more affordable, accessible, all serve the community, promote stewardship, and educate on the health and wellness. That's our mission and vision. In 2018, to go along with the Tech Farms, we established Glenwood Gardens. With my current role and responsibilities within NRCS, education is a big part of that, technical soil services. I educate quite a bit on the land and our natural resources, soil, plants, air, water, the environment. Did a lot of fifth grade, third grade, high school presentations about the way our rangelands at that time, our native grasslands responded to fire and grazing and the interaction with the environment. That's what I did a lot. And I really enjoyed that, teaching and educating and the children. I think it's an extremely important tool or extremely important event that we need to refocus on. And I hope that's what these urban ag farms do, is to help re-educate children where the food comes from. But so that's the foundation's mission, is to promote a healthy way of life through education and growing and consuming nutritious food. We have several little stories about kids coming to the farm and honestly, not knowing where a carrot comes from, you know, they get there dirty and you just watch them. It's priceless to a kid understand and plan the soil, plan the dirt, and look where his food comes from and realizing that it's priceless. So 2018, we set up that foundation. Go ahead. And then, so these urban farms are, you know, Secretary Vilsack is extremely proactive in these urban farms. It's actually, there's departmental regulation on the importance of small farms and the role that they play on the U.S. agriculture sector. It's huge. The USDA just came out with, they launched a Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovation Production at NRCS. It's part of the 2018 Farm Bill. So these urban farms are extremely, they are spotlighted right now more than ever. And we can thank, you know, Secretary Vilsack for that, for sure. This is his second time as Department USDA Secretary. He was 4 years ago under the Obama administration. Biden hired him again. So extremely instrumental. I look for changes coming with regard to him. And I think all improvements, I think everything's for the good. So that kind of what the slides say there. But we are a 5.8 acre farm. It's an older picture. We have 7 high tunnels, NRCS funded. Those tunnels, that's a cost share program. It's not a grant. So you do have some inputs with regard to that. They are 30 by 72. We have a post-harvest facility that you can see in the back. We could not have done that without partners, Kansas Health Food Initiative, Kansas Blue Cross Blue Shield, Healthy Living. There's extremely a lot of individuals involved with doing that. We are certified organic. This is our fourth year now. And it's Oklahoma Department of Ag. I got something on my slide here. Let me get that off. Agriculture, Food and Forestry. So I actually called the Kansas Department of Ag and go, hey, why aren't you certifying? Why can't you guys certify? Things like that. They're just, I guess there just wasn't enough supply demand type. And so Oklahoma was the closest. There was a Lincoln, Nebraska also has one cert that can certify, but people ask why, you know, why'd you go to Oklahoma? Well, that was the closest. I did call them and they said, no, we're not taking anymore. And then I kind of hung up the phone, but I was pretty persistent with them. I kind of wanted them, with the Southern Great Plains. I felt that we would, have kind of the same, climate, commonalities. But anyways, I was persistent and they let me in. So I was fortunate for that. We can talk more about that. So what is organic? There is a lot of record keeping. We have to fill out a form. It's called FS. It's not important, but it's I didn't write it down. It's a FS 5125, but essentially there's no synthetics. There is a lot of regulations that you do follow. But you know, why did we go organic and want to be certified? We were really kind of doing that anyway with regard to our practices. We never were really a chemical or a fertilizer type practices. We never really did any of that. I guess it's because I don't know. I had an understanding of soil, the microbiology, the magic that happens underneath, and what goes on in the interactions between the billions of microorganisms. That's fascinating to me. And I didn't want to ruin that natural, setting with anything. And that's just my personal belief. So we chose to just do it, quote unquote, kind of use natural, growing crops, always have something on the ground, covered. Can you guys still see me? I got a message there. Okay. All right. So cover crop. This is an example of how do we fertilize then? What do we do? Well, we use green manure. You can call it green manure, or cover. So after, this is Austrian winter peas, legume, it's wheat, rye, some clover in there. So what we do after harvest, this would be like tomatoes. We're done with tomatoes, you know, October, and we cleaning up the high tunnel. We'll go in there and seed, this crop, and I just spread it. I just broadcast it, and then I, rotary harrow, I have a BCS and just lightly, you know, an inch or two cover the seed, and then, oh, it's so good. Beautiful. It comes up right away, and it's over winters, and then in the spring it comes up again. So I just flail mower. I have a flail mower, and so it just pulverizes this stuff into the ground, and then it serves to cover a weed suppression. It provides carbon nitrogen ratio, nitrogen to soil. It feeds the bugs is what's going on, and the bugs then release the good stuff to the plants. So we do a lot of cover crops, both indoors and outdoors, right? We use a lot of compost. This is another cover crop, but kind of cover crop went wild and wrong. This high tunnel is full of garlic, and I planted the cover crop as well. And so garlic didn't like competition and was like, oh, you know, I messed up really. But, you know, in that mess up, I don't think it really.
It was labor intensive.
It was very labor intensive, but it was, we had to go in there and manually scissor cut a whole entire cover crop between these garlics. But it's going to turn out good. And the compost, we do have three large piles. We get horse manure, not on a day, but a week across the street. There's horses and they bring their manure, clean out their stables, bring out their manure. We have hay, big 1,000-pound bales of hay. We roll out, and so we layer grass clippings, manure, horse manure, leaves, and we just keep layering that. And we'll let that sit for a year. To do compost correctly, we would, you know, be turning that thing five times, monitoring temperature, 143 for five to three consecutive days. A lot of times I don't have the equipment to do that, but we do let those things sit for at least 3 years. Go ahead. So this is new. We don't have chickens in our house all the time, but these girls, we have chickens on site, and this is high tunnel 6 and 7, where we didn't have any crops growing. We had a lot of weeds. We just had a lot of residue and weeds come up, and they cleaned it. They did all that. You couldn't have walked through there. They're pretty amazing at scratching around and providing a manure for a nitrogen source. And so here's a chicken tractor. We did have chickens in a coop, and then that was, to me, I don't know, disgusting is not the word, but it just smelled, and they're there. Yeah, they provide you eggs, but you're feeding them a lot of input. I was like, let's get these girls out and on the land and trying to work for us and with us. And that's what they did. Two days. They scratch around, get the weed seed, get the insects, and then we can go plant behind them. And there's some rules about planting. I think we got another slide to show that.
Yeah, I see, Leah, you've asked a question, and it's coming up in the next slide right here.
So, yeah, so there's a 90-120-day rule. We've got manure. Doesn't matter if it's cow, chicken, horse. If you're gonna utilize a raw manure, you're going to have to apply it 90-120 days, depending on the crop, prior to harvest. So like a tomato would be 90 days as that crop grows upright. So you have to incorporate that manure, that raw manure, 90 days before you would harvest your first tomato, and 120 days for something that grows prostrate on the ground, like lettuce, something like that. So we definitely do that and monitor that. And our organic certifier will definitely be honest about that. They'll want to know exactly.
There's semantics in the gap as well, covering the same thing, because more and more people are doing it. These are slides I just took in my last visit out at Hutchinson Farm. Those of you that will be coming out and seeing it in person, you'll get a much better look. But there's just a number of things that really stood out to me as just relatively innovative. Getting into the food safety, we'll take a good look at their pack house when we take the tour. And the whole thing, to me, was just designed with efficiency and safety in mind. And you'll get a firsthand look, those of you coming up. But one of the things that stood out to me, you've got a 3-vat sink that it integrates an aerating system. You want to just talk about that real quick?
Yeah, so we like to grow lettuce, leafy greens. And this is a triple rinse. We triple rinse our lettuce. That is it's not novel concept. I found this. We do a lot of tours. We go places. We see other people's farms. Took this from maybe it was from a farm up in Maine, whatever, but they used a jacuzzi pump, and they use air to bubble the two of the sinks to get all the sand or debris or bugs or whatever off of the lettuce. So we'll cut the lettuce, put a load in that first sink there, and the bubbles will knock off all the sand, knock off the dirt, the bugs, and then it'll do it again in a second vat. There'll be more bubbles there, and then it gets rinsed in the third vat. So that's a triple rinse type. And then after that, it gets dried. So from time to harvest to the time it goes in the cooler needs to be extremely, we try to get it within 45 minutes. But the quicker you can get everything dried, the longer that lettuce lasts. We, you know, 2 to 3 weeks our lettuce lasts in a refrigerator. Because we dry it. And that's what that's a washing machine, and you've probably seen it. That one long deal too. You take these things and it gets rid of that moisture. There's another process. I don't have a slide on this, but we'll put that on some fan on a street, and then we'll blow air to it. So we'll try to get that even drier. It's like a four step, very labor intensive lettuces, but, so our success, these are, how do we measure success? It's got to be enjoyable and profitable. Profitable, not so much. We do enjoy it. It takes a lot of work, though, you know, at a farm, as you guys might know, starting from the ground up. It'll get there, and I'm not worried about that so much. I do have a full-time job that can support it. I'm fortunate. A lot of people don't like that. They're actually doing it for income, but we're fortunate to have my job so I can do it this way. We are having fun. If it's not enjoyable, profitable, it's not success. So that's our ways to measure success. How do I get rid of that season? Permanent. So what are we looking at the future? We have a permanent farm. This is an iterative process. It builds upon itself. And, you know, we got the pack house. We had the high tunnels with the pack house. Now we need to, you know, marketing and labor are our two most challenging obstacles in this business. Did hire a part-time employee, which is extremely helpful. They will be the success to the farm as far as profitability. And so we're doing a permanent market on Hendrix, which would be a place where individuals could come in and buy our produce or pick up our produce. I can't read the, what's the second one say there? Seasonal. Sorry, I can't see my slide. Let me see here. Just a minute, Peter. Okay. We are involved. Well, we do have our abilities to take SNAP, which is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Seasonal employees, there it is. I looked into good agriculture practices, being certified on that. The reasons we would do that would be for schools. There are some subsidies that the schools could take advantage of with regard to buying their food from local farmers. But some of the caveats to that would be that the farmers have to be GAP certified.
Yeah. Chris, we'll go into more detail on that third
perfect
presentation we've got.
Perfect.
And Chris, both Chris and Leah really do stand out in my travels around the state, just in their evolution. Chris is starting to talk about it now, but we'll focus on our third presentation, just that evolution in cultivation and processing, and then the sales and the distribution have different implications for their food safety. We'll focus more on that as we move ahead.
Beautiful. Okay, good. Hey, it's a collaborative effort, not only these people, but people that we're talking to today. You know, communication, it wouldn't be possible without every one of these individuals. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas, Kansas Healthy Food Initiative Network Kansas, the foundation, local county health department. If you need any, if you want to go ahead, that's fine. you'll reach out to me, techfarms.com, techfarms@gmail.com. And there's my phone number. Again, Peter, thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to the rest of the presentations and answering any questions, and really look forward to the tour.
All right, thanks. Wrong one. Okay, next up, Leah, we're going to be going through a just pretty much an online tour of your place.
Okay.
Just a moment.
I just want to give a forewarning that I just got a notice on my computer that my internet connection has been deemed unstable. So if you lose me, I may run into the house or...
And as a disclaimer, I'm on the same system. So if you lose me, it'll be about, we'll come back in a minute. But for now, let's get started with a tour of just a brief overview. And again, we will focus our, this presentation, just as an overview on RISE. It'd be kind of a tag team between Leah and me right now. Leah, do you want to give a brief overview of the history behind RISE rooftop operations?
I'd be happy to, and I want to take an opportunity before we start to thank you and KSCGA and Farmers Union for the opportunity to participate in today's event. I was asked in 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic, I decided to close for the year because I'd say 80 to 90% of everything I grow is sold to restaurants. And with all the restaurants closing down, I thought I wouldn't have a lot of sales opportunities and I didn't want to reposition to retail. So I just closed down for the year. And shortly after I made that decision, I had a guy reach out to me. We've been talking about, he's a local developer, and we've been talking about grocery stores and kitchens, and we've floated several projects between us and never had one of them work. And so he reached out to me. He'd been in touch with Fidelity Bank, and they wanted to launch a rooftop farm on their brand new 5-story parking, car park is what they call it. And he asked if I would be interested in bidding that project and working with them to develop it. And of course I said, yes, I jumped at the opportunity to do so. I worked with the architects from the ground up. I spent about 6 months researching. We took trips to view rooftop farms in Chicago and St. Louis, and worked with the architects, the engineers, and the result was that we designed RISE Farm. So I've been in business for 8 years as Firefly Farm. It was my husband's family's farmstead, and it's located just on the city limits, the eastern city limits between Wichita and Andover. And the farm was built in 1916, and his parents bought it in 1950. So we're the second generation to work this farm. Yeah, we've tried a lot of different, our growing program is number one at Firefly Farm, but we have gotten pretty heavily into agritourism. So we did farm-to-table dinners for 4 years. We did a farmer's book club, and this grew out of my own necessity to meet people who were doing the same thing I was doing and to read and discuss what we were learning about the modern styles of specialty crop farming. We did a farmer's market for 4 years. It was extremely popular. We had 1,000 people come through every 2 hours. And then we did private parties and events. And most of those have gone by the wayside as we have focused more and more and more on our growing program. Like the Tecklenburgs were at Firefly Farm very interested in our soil. It's all about soil health. It's all about, I often call it eco-agriculture. Regenerative agriculture is another popular term today. We don't use any commercial inputs. We use organic processes, but we do not, but we are not organically certified. In 2020, I started a collaboration between myself and Sarah Stevens Selman at Tallgrass Hemp and Cannabis. She's on a has been on a SARE grant last year and this year. I really like the concept of a terroir or growing for a region. And if you look at a lot of the hemp, the breeding of those seeds are coming from the East and West Coast. So we've been real interested in trying to do some crossbreeding on some non-registered open domain hemp seed. It's the newest and oldest fiber grain and food crop in Kansas. We're particularly looking at the fiber and grains aspect of that. So as I said, we now run 2 farms as of this year and partnering with Fidelity Bank on the rooftop. Fidelity bought the, paid for the infrastructure, and we own the business. So it's an outstanding collaboration. It's one of the largest, as far as I know, it is the largest, but there could be something out there I don't know about. So I say it's one of the largest rooftop farms in the Midwest. It's located in the heart of downtown Wichita, Kansas. It's 15,000 square foot. It's called Rise Farms because it also has a solar farm situated on a roof above the fifth floor. And that solar array produces enough electricity to run the farm, the entire parking garage, which is outfitted with electrical charging stations, plus all of the retail on the first floor. We are still in progress. We still have some construction going on at our farm. We were tasked, the bank, when we bid and got the contract to run Rice Farms. They had a few things that were really important to them. First and foremost, they've got a local restaurant on the first floor, First Mile Canteen, and they have a sister restaurant, First Mile Kitchen in Bradley Fair. Their whole goal is to source as close to 1 mile away as possible. So we're growing on the rooftop and they have their canteen on the first floor and we're going to sell extensively to them. Our second goal was to sell to other local restaurants. Right now we sell to about 30 local restaurants. We just like the scale of restaurant sales. We started retail sales last year with the launching of our food hub. We have education is like the Tecklenburgs. It's very important to me. And so we designed a layout to accentuate our ability to do education with the way we arranged various crops. And I'll talk about that in a minute.
One of the reasons I approached Leah to be a part of this, they've got a unique situation. They've got the growing operations upstairs. They've got a packing and processing facility up on the roof with their growing operations. And right downstairs is the restaurant. So they're going to be doing a wide variety of cutting and processing above and beyond that. So we'll talk about this in more detail in the food safety component aspect of this. But once you go beyond that initial harvest cut, you just open up a whole bunch of doors you got to go through. And they are unique. And Tecklenburg's same thing, and they're supplying schools. We'll take a look at some of the doors and windows that open up as you approach these different types of processing for distribution. Quick tour. I got a tour. And again, when you guys come and see it today, and I know a lot of you are on the road right now, are probably getting internet or at least cell service intermittently. We'll see you there. They've got it laid out to accommodate pedestrian traffic, foot traffic. And go ahead and talk about your zones 1 and 2.
Yeah. So zone 1 is perennial. We won't have an overwhelming amount of production for our perennial crops, but we plan that area because foot traffic in the picture, you can see the doors in the background, and foot traffic will enter the farm through those doors. And we didn't want to be turning those crops over a lot when we're having tours and educational opportunities. So you're looking at zone 2, which is our cut flower program. We have 1,500 tulips in there, and then we're going to go to poppies, and then we're going to go to a mixed flower program. Only 3 successions in that area this year. They are in earthway boxes, so we've already seen some issues with sun and shade, and the really great thing is you can pick those up and move them off. So they have a water reserve in the bottom. They're watered with spaghetti tubing, and they have the little indentation in the middle is an overflow, so we can keep their roots from getting too wet, and they'll wick from the bottom up. So we're pretty excited about that. This is zone 3, which are a series of individual rows. They're 30-inch rows, 36 feet. Everything was laid out on 12, 24, 36 feet in increments. These beds can all be taken apart and put back together in any configuration you want. This is our leafy greens program. We'll have, right now we've only planned through spring and summer, but I think all told in those 2 seasons, we plan to turn over those crops 6 times, 6 sessions in those first 2 seasons. Then we move into zone 4, which is a larger plot, and we have 3 of them on the west side, and then 2 down at the south end. They're 36 feet long and 32 feet wide, and we'll have traditional specialty crops in those beds. The growing medium, one of the issues for us is even though we're in
Well, it looks like Leah froze up. I can continue. Can people still hear me?
And soilless growing medium, which just shocked me when I realized we were moving forward with that, because I'm really a soil person through and through. But I did quite a bit of research and found out that roof light is a product that is made of shale. It's heated to 200 degrees and then blown full of air. And 70% is compost. And so we're watering in our nutrients and our mycorrhizal products. Whoops. Okay. Can you, yeah, I think, can
You're
you
back.
Still hear?
Yeah. You're back.
Okay. So it's, we had some real concerns about it, but we, everything we've grown has done beautifully so far. So we have, it's really an honor to be able to work, collaborate with the bank. One of the things that they put in for us is a really super smart irrigation system. It's a Netafim system, which is an Israeli company. They're used exclusively through the Middle East and Europe and Canada. And we're really honored to have such a high-end system. We also have a fertigation system attached to that. And so we're really excited to be getting that going. We're a little bit in a period of on-off right now. Our fifth area up on the roof is our hoop house. And half of our hoop house is for growing, winter growing. And the other half is for a propagation tunnel. We have a germination room and a propagation tunnel. So we have a germination chamber where we, and a small room where we do our seeding. Everything goes into the germ chamber. Then it goes under lights after it's germinated until it gets its first or second round of true leaves. And then it goes over to the propagation tunnel and the tables in the north half. And then we're, of course, able to grow all winter. There you see the germ chamber, and there you see the tables. They're getting a lot fuller since that picture was taken.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it today. It just laid out in a way, like Leah said. I mean, it goes from germination to the tables into the, it's laid out with extended growing seasons in mind. They're going to be supplying fresh produce for downtown Wichita year round, the way it's set up. And also included, we'll take a closer look on the tours. Just got a couple of pictures here. Again, you're going to have a processing and packing room, and it's all, again, you had the luxury of actually designing it with the architects, and it's just laid out for safety. All the surfaces, the drains, the cooling sections, the storage area, it's all just laid out for flow and safety in mind. And at the end, we'll get a look at it today, but downstairs, again, you've got a restaurant. You'll be feeding it just via the elevator there on the site, which is impacting your packaging and processing upstairs and also your food safety requirements. And Leah's talked about it already. She's looking ahead. They have evolved, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in the next presentation, but they've evolved as a genuine food hub and the focal point of a food hub, getting sourcing. And this year, they're looking ahead to making that a bit more formal arrangement and looking at some of the food safety certification and licensures required with that. Also looking again ahead, downtown Wichita is a food desert. Leah, there are no grocery stores, I believe, in downtown Wichita. And again, looking ahead, there's opportunities here, and we're excited to have them be a part of this. Okay, thanks. Okay, and next, I'm going to bring up another PowerPoint and screen share. We're going to take a look in general, and in very general terms. Let's get out of that. We're going to look at general terms of some of the food safety certification and licensure paths that they had to take. I'll bring that up and I'll screen share. Okay. Now, I want to be very clear here. When we designed this program, I was in the midst of traveling around the state, connecting with Kansas Specialty Crop Growers Association. We've got over 100 actual members, but a reach of about 300 growers in our network system right now. And rather than set up a formal food safety training, I would like to, and we set this up as taking a look at two growers in what seem to be exemplary evolutionary processes. They've gone from, you know, just very informal sales, word of mouth from their, out of their home gardens. And they become, again, Tecklenburg's, are, they become a distribution source for schools. Leah's branching off into the restaurants, looking at other market possibilities. And we're going to take a look at how they have moved through the food safety requirement and certification process. And I will repeat this throughout this. In the end, I think the bottom line is growers need to educate themselves. We will likely not be able to answer all your questions today. That is not our intent. Our intent is to help figure out what the questions are. And I do see Manreet is here. And Manreet, please pipe in whenever you may have something to add. And he'll be at the tours as well and can answer questions. Why don't we take a look at three different of the food safety certification licensure processes that they've dealt with. The FSMA, Food Safety Modernization Act, that registration process. Both of them have had to negotiate through Kansas Department of Agriculture food processing, storage, and food establishment requirements for their distribution. And we'll take a look at GAP as well and how that fits into their evolution. We're going to do a quick overview here of FSMA. Taking a look at, number one, do you need it? And just going to go through, there is a, and we will have all these, we will have, oh, thank you. I just got an introduction. Adam Inman from KDA Food Safety's here. Thank you for letting us know. Again, I think you're tucked into my second page. Thanks for letting us know. Looking forward to having your input as well. Right now, though, this is just right out of one of the materials. We'll have all of our resources and references that we refer to today posted on a follow-up webpage, and they'll get out to all the participants after we conduct our session today. Take a look at Do You Need It? A lot of you are familiar with it. In short, does your farm grow, harvest, or hold produce? The produce defined. I'm not going to read it all, but produce as defined. If the answer is yes, you need to be thinking along the lines that I need FSMA. Next question, is the produce that you grow, that you cultivate, is it one of those that is usually processed, cooked? It's not, it is, if it's one that is considered as rarely consumed raw, now you may be exempt. You need to do some research. And again, in the materials we'll post it is a lengthy list of what that produce is. Do you sell more than $25,000 or more? You need to be looking at FSMA. Again, just real quick on this one. Do you treat? Do you process? Do you cook? Do you distill? Do you treat your produce that you are raising in a way that greatly reduces the potential for microorganism contamination? If you do, you can maybe look ahead. In the end, if you decide you need it, and Chris, if you're still on, you've had some experience in this, and other growers do pipe in. If you do, in fact, need it, we'll go through the process, but keep in mind that the requirements are intentionally rather broad in this. You see a lot of terms as you need to take reasonable measures, or at a minimum that you need to do certain things. The process, you go through training. Tecklenburg's event, Leah, you just took the training, correct? There's trainings. I looked at the calendar about a month ago. There were trainings, FSMA trainings offered throughout the state. Someone from your farm needs to go and get that. And then Leah is going to set up a training program for her employees as needed on site. You go through the training. And then once you've done that, you need to be in compliance. You need to take a look at your operations and make sure you have things in order. And again, there's a very, very lengthy webpage that we will share with people that's got some of the more details. But in general, you just need to make sure you're doing things safely. Inspections. Just keep in mind, any grower can be inspected. Any grower in the country can be inspected. Right now, the FDA, who's behind this, they are using public records to take a look at growers, and they'll give you notification. Chris Tecklenburg, you're still here. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you've actually gone through an inspection before, correct?
Oh, yeah, the three of them.
You've been through
every
three.
Year.
You want to just briefly talk about your experience with that?
Yeah, it I just talked to my rep, KDA rep, yesterday. They had some turnover and turnaround, and so different people had come at different times, but it was always announced. It's never been, here's surprise, I'm showed up, but they work with you, work well, as long as the communication lines are equal, as long as you're asking those questions, you have something that is in question, make sure, I always made sure I asked the question, I call it a very open relationship. Although they're a regulatory agency, I try to let that not get into my, the operation, like what I can't do, but more of a learning kind of opportunity. So it takes 30 to minutes to an hour. They'll go through their checklist. And after you've done it once, it's pretty routine after that. You kind of know what to expect, what they're looking for and at, temperature of water, water temp, the things, cleanliness, what do you do? Yeah, it's only organic, but so those kind of things, Peter.
Yeah, and again, I see Adam, you've got your hand up. Working with Manrita on this, he affirms just to date, at least upward through last year, they're focusing more on educating both the growers and the inspectors as well as to what's going on out there. They're not in a situation right now to initiate penalties, but it's more of an educational process that will evolve in time. Adam, you've got your hand up.
Yeah. Good morning. Just briefly to clarify this, I know that there's just so many different layers to what farm operations and the different iterations that there are out there. And so for Chris's experience, it's going to be a little bit different in that his inspections that he's had are for his food processing license side of the house versus a produce grower that's not doing that diversified value added type of stream. And so that's going to be more frequent than a produce grower that's not doing any of that type of thing. So the actual produce safety farm inspections, the FDA has put out their approach to that. They're directing the actual produce safe rule inspection work planning and directing that. And it's very limited in scope. As you can imagine, across the country, there's some very, very large producers nationally. And so that the actual on-farm inspections in Kansas, we are going to be probably pretty limited for just the produce safety side of things. So then when we get into the value-added processing types of activities, that's where that model changes. And then of course, when you overlay that with GAPS, good agricultural practices, certifications that folks may have, or as Chris was talking about, the organic certifications, then that can add even more visits to the farm. So we always try to introduce ourselves in whatever capacity that we may be interacting with people. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Okay, thanks. Reasons to do it. I think a lot of people have heard this. Chris, in my visits with the Tecklenburgs, they took it early on just to educate themselves at what it may lay ahead. And it was a great starting point just to develop and design their practices and look ahead. And we come back to this both with FSMA, but also with the voluntary GAP. it's the right thing to do. Growers, even new growers, are very aware in my travels around the state. One incident will have repercussions throughout the entire industry. So getting trained and getting some practices in place to reduce the possibility of that happening is going to be a benefit to the industry as a whole. Okay, and Adam, I see you're here. Chris has been talking with his KDA contact, and we have been working with the folks at K-State Extension and putting this together. Both Chris and Leah have evolved to a point in their cultivation, processing, packaging, and distribution. They needed to look at Kansas Department of KDA, Kansas Department of Agriculture requirements. And just to begin with, most of our growers, particularly the smaller ones, they are exempt from this. Key words here, foods that are allowed to be sold directly to consumers in Kansas without licensing. Key words, uncut, not cut beyond normal harvesting, and also directly to a customer. Those are the two main branch points in this. So, you know, for all of you that are selling to farmers markets on your own side markets, you're likely good because you're selling it directly to consumers, the people that are going to eat it and take it home, and they'll process it and cook it. And it's not cut beyond basic harvest cuts. Once you've established that you are doing that, you look at both Tech and Firefly. Once you start, particularly with the leafy greens and other things that are explicitly listed, tomatoes, melons, and there are others, once it's cut beyond normal harvesting, you are now in the realm of food processing. And if you're selling it to a food establishment defined as a business that prepares or offers food for immediate consumption, meaning you're selling it to a restaurant where it's consumed right there, it's prepared and consumed right there. Schools, consumed, it's prepared and they eat it right there. And Chris, if you're still on with Tech, if you want to briefly talk about, you actually have initiated relationships providing schools. You want to talk about that real quick and its implications as you understand them with your food safety requirements?
Yeah, I think you nailed it there. The food, it took me a while to understand the food processing and food establishment. I knew I needed them. I didn't fully understand them. So I took a lot of reading, but yet those standards and regulations are very thick. So, again, I worked, closely with the individual, the certifier, but my food processing license, it does cover that. Since I cut my lettuce twice, cut it from the field, and then we come in here and we mix, 12 different species together, and we cut it a second time. That covers my processing. And we also sell to markets, whether it be a grocery store or who else, or wherever in town, hospital, that covers the food processing. Then the establishment would be directly to the public. That's who I want to sell to as well. So that covers both of those. And with regard to the schools, there's been recent, they've called me with regard to 309 Nickerson, and they have an opportunity to purchase local foods without being GAP certified and provide some snacks in the form of like kale chips and things like that with their school. So we're starting that process right now, and having those licenses, then especially to the grocery stores, they're accountable too. So they're going to get audited, or they're going to get checked, and they can't be buying from farmers without these types of licenses. So it's good mutual.
And real quick, Adam, just is reaffirming something, and read into this. It requires a food establishment license two questions, that you're cutting it, you're processing it beyond the normal harvest cut, and it's going to a place where they're going to be eating it on the spot, a restaurant or a school. That requires a food establishment. You can, however, sell to a restaurant or a school if all you're doing is that basic harvest cut. And I know a lot of people are doing that, correct? My experience, my home is in the urban-rural interface around Kansas City, and I've been to a couple of markets where restaurants are there buying on the spot. As long as they're buying it from somebody that is just doing the basic harvest cut, you're good. Yep, just want to clarify that. Anything else to add on that, Adam?
No, yeah, it's exactly right. So the processing, if you're going direct to consumer, then you have to ask about the processing more specifically as well. If you're just doing that uncut produce, you can sell to schools and other wholesale type outlets, restaurants, grocery stores, without having a license. If you do aggregation on your farm and store that produce for some period of time, that's another license question that we work through.
Yeah, Leah is actually going to be doing that. We're going to be going that in as we move ahead. Thanks. I'm glad you're here. Again, we are going to post this information in the end. You need to educate yourself, but there's a lot of little fine print exemptions. Those of you that are doing berries, there you can actually cut herbs, berries, carrots, and a couple of other things. They're specifically listed. You can, in fact, do home canned fruits and jellies. A lot of exemptions, so educate yourself. But big brushstrokes, again, Chris's experience with this, I think, is rather exemplary. And Leah, again, is going to have a packing and processing facility, you know, five stories above a restaurant. It's likely that they're going to be doing preparing salads and things like that. So they're going to be doing the food establishment as well. Then you move into the food processor and subcategory of that of food storage. Leah comes up in this one. Again, if you're aggregating, Leah, if you're still on and still have internet connection, you're actually going to be bringing in produce from other growers and preparing it as well for your food hub as you evolve.
Correct.
So again, that's going to be under a food storage. You're actually going to be storing it in that. And the primary category here, food processor, subcategory food storage. You don't need both. If you're storing, you can get both of them in one. But processor, if you look at this list, highlighted packaging, cutting, again, beyond that basic harvest cut, mixing for sale or distribution to other business entities. Again, if it's for immediate consumption, you're under the establishment. Again, our intent here, if you can figure out what the questions are you need to ask yourself as you move ahead. Leah has done this. There's a what we call the six times or less exemption. If you are preparing foods for events or something six times or less in a year, then you can be, emphasize, can be exempt. Leah, if you're still there, you want to talk about what you've done with this?
Well, last year, we're really interested in how to make food as accessible as driving through a fast food establishment. So we wanted to test the market last year. And so it goes by the 24-hour increment. It sets a clock and you have 24, six, seven, maybe Adam can clarify for us, but 24-hour periods. So we wanted to test how well we were trying to figure out whether we want to move into this arena. And so we held these last year. Yes, and that's right. And we sold direct to consumer. That's correct.
Yep, thanks. Direct to consumer.
Right.
Okay. And again, looking ahead, Firefly, we already talked about this. You're going to be bringing in food from other suppliers eventually, if the hub
builds out.
And again, mm-hmm. If so, you're going to be under the food storage. Again, you're storing it in the process of supplying other distribution systems or sellers. Exactly. Process, look at it again, general terms, just to get an idea what it entailed. It's based on your square feet. Generally starts at about $325 for the first year, and after that, it's a little bit less. To date, talking with Chris, he is not, Chris, refresh my memory, but you have not been inspected yet for your KDA licensure, correct?
Not this year, but we did re-up it and it's current, but yep. Yeah. Yeah,
but I was just curious on growers' experience with the actual inspections. The two focus growers that I've got this have not yet been inspected, but they are both, Leah, again, is going to be pursuing that this year, and Chris has been certified for a couple of years now. Okay, we're going to go through GAP. There's a lot of push to get people GAP certified, and just keep in mind, again, these are voluntary audits that are done to minimize risk. Again, it's done to reduce the chance that a major event, a major incident will occur that'll affect the industry as a whole. It's broken down 7 parts. Those of you familiar with it, oops, sorry. First part, including farm review, field harvest, and field packing, house packing, storage and transportation. They do have a section, a class wholesale distribution center terminal warehouses, which in my understanding has been discontinued this year. And they'll be replacing that this summer with good manufacturing places. So educate yourself on these. We're gonna take a look at these and what it means. Some people have explored the possibility of group GAP. Talking with the folks at K-State Extension, if you've got a group of people in a network, either vertical or horizontal network of some sort, you can get group GAP. You can spread the payments, the cost at least, over a number of growers, which reduces it for each of you. And then random members of your group are audited. Now, from the folks at K-State and my at least growers experience around the state that I've talked to, you really need to have some pretty strong relationships and trust and commitment. If you think ahead, what could possibly go wrong if you've got a network of a dozen growers and one gets inspected and the implications affect all of you? You really need to be committed as a group to do this. That's our disclaimer for that. Now, looking at some of the reasons, I want to talk to Chris about this a bit. They're actually pursuing it. The language in GAP, it may open avenues for your expanded distribution. Yeah, it may, maybe. And in some cases, it actually does. Chris, if you want to talk briefly, you've actually identified a school subsidy program that can actually increase your distribution potential that requires GAP. You want to talk about that real quick, Chris?
Yeah. So that my whole experience with GAP would be a whole other license. But again, you hit it, like, why would I need that license? And so I pursued that because I like the concept of GAP, good agricultural practices. But, you know, if we were already doing it, kind of, it's like, this is one other level. Is this a higher tier? What's going on? And so my, you know, in further investigation, then it's, there are some subsidies for the schools that, if they want to participate in, they will get funding from the government to purchase food from local producers. I think that's a great concept. I think that opens doors for many growers. And the caveat that would be is those local producers would need to be GAP certified in order for them to produce that, in order for them to buy that produce from that farm. A little further into that, you start talking to the schools, and it's somebody has to walk them through that process and that subsidies. That's not an easy deal, and you almost have to sell that because it's a commitment to the schools to do that. Do they have the facilities to take the produce? What produce? And so I haven't left that arena. I'm still pursuing that, but it's going to take a little bit on both ends. My GAP certification and the school's responsibility to, you know, what can they handle? How much do they need? What facilities do they need to do? So that's my GAP as far.
And I wanted to highlight that, again, in the language that you see in GAP, it may open avenues, and And the Tecklenburgs have identified a case where it literally does. And he has got an opportunity to, there's a need to actually educate the distribution system vertically. I mean, he has to go higher up to educate them. This is a case where taking the lead initiative really may end up paying off in the long run. And Leah, again, one of the reasons that I've kind of latched on to Leah and Firefly and Rise, you hear about this concept of food hub, and I think most people will agree it's thrown around way too much. Leah has an opportunity to take a lead role in a genuine food hub in the region here. They've already looked at, they're going to be pursuing their state licensure requirements as a storing and aggregating facility. But again, here's a case where, you know, Leah is considering, can emphasize considering GAP, because they're going to be building this system from the ground, no pun intended, but from the ground up. And they could actually initiate GAP as a uniform standard of practice for all the people that are involved in it. They actually can use elements of GAP to provide safety standards for the system. But again, they're taking the lead here. They're going to be developing this from the beginning. And in the end, educate yourself. GAP, the word from some of the folks at K-State that I work with, they may really push GAP, but in the end, don't go get it because you think you're going to, you may identify a grocery store. Oh, I'll get GAP. Talk to the end distribution. Talk to the folks you're going to sell it to beforehand. And again, you may be in a situation like Leah and Chris are. You may be in a situation to educate them where GAP actually may came in. All right. I've got some pictures here of just some of the things that are in place on the farms, but I think I'll hold off on that. And we'll see some of the infrastructure, the equipment, and the practices in place. I'll show maybe one or two here just to give you an idea of what the semantics, the narrative is like. Here's Leah's spot. I mean, it's in here right out of GAP Part 4. Is this a climate-controlled room? Yes. Is it monitored? Yes. Will there be records kept? This is the level that some of these practices are done at. Looking ahead, here, very simple thing. At Chris's, at Tecklenburg's, again, the food packing material, this is right out of the FSMA stuff. Is it cleanable or designed for single use? These are single use containers. Is it unlikely to support or grow? Is it stored in a way that it's safe? Stored above ground? And you will see at both these places, they're pretty darn clean. This is the level at some of these requirements and certification practices are written at. They're generally broad in most cases. And again, it's up to you and in your inspection to see if you're actually meeting these in the way that you're doing them in specific application practices. I think I'm going to wrap that up, though, and open it up. We've got about 15 minutes. If there's any more comments or questions, anybody, just no need to raise your hand. Just go ahead and pipe up if you've got any questions or comments.
Peter, this is Mary Howell. Yep. And I got from Londa at K-State that they are going, they've had interest in another FSMA training, PSA training, and they are going to offer one on April 28th and 29th for anybody who's interested. The cost is $20, and Farmers Union has funds through our grant to pay their registration fee, and it will be a virtual training. So they can get a hold of us, and we can direct them to how to sign up.
We'll post that. Like I said, I'll set up kscga.org. We will set up a web page, a follow-up web page in the next 72 hours. It'll be up, and I'll email it to all the participants that will have all these resources. And we've got a couple people that have piped in already, too, that there are safety training going on around the state. Very heavy in the winter and spring, but we'll get those posted. Thanks. Anyone else? Well, great. Again, this was intended just to take a look at the process, in the evolution of two, in my opinion, in my travels around the state, pretty remarkable growers, and just the way that they've put some foresight and planning into what they're doing and what they envision doing in the years ahead. And they're looking ahead. Leah had a nice way of framing it. You had, you always want to be us plus one. Is that us plus one? You're muted.
I plus one. Yeah, wherever the standard is, plus one, we always want to strive for excellence, or wherever our own knowledge is, plus one, we always want to push to get that extra little bit of knowledge or set our standards just a little higher. That's just the way we envision it.
Good. Thanks. Okay. I'm going to, real quick, I'm going to post the website. Those of you, most of you already have it. I believe all of you do. We are anticipating upwards to 25 or 30 people at the on the in-person tours. And just FYI, if you haven't looked at the email that was sent out more closely, the tour, we've given an hour and a half between each. The tour at Rise's downtown operations are going to start at 1 o'clock. The building is a secure building. There's parking on the first floor, and we will likely need overflow parking. That overflow parking is going to be across the street on the north side, and we will have some staff there to guide people. And to get into the building, to get into the elevators and let you up, you'll need to be let in. It's a secure building. It's a Fidelity Bank building on a Saturday. We should have somebody there, probably about 12:30 to start letting people in. So go grab a bite to eat. And I just posted in the comment section, if you don't have directions and all the information, there's the web page that's got the map links and everything else. And then everyone, I encourage you, that's about a 1 hour drive then up to Hutchinson. And then at 4 o'clock, we will have the tour of the Tecklenburg's operations, Tech Farms. All right. Okay. Thank you, all of you. Again, in the next 48 to 72 hours, you'll get an email with the web page with all of our resources. This has been recorded. We'll have the PowerPoint presentations up. All of you, drive safe. I see quite a few of you are driving from as far away as Liberal, Garden City, and Johnson County. Drive safe, and we'll see you up at the roof on the Rise operations. Thanks.
Thank you.